This is St. Louis Public Radio. As the St. Louis Rams consider moving to Los Angeles, there's a debate brewing here about whether or not the Rams should stay. Backers say the NFL provides an economic boost and a dose of pride for St. Louisans. Others aren't sure that having a team is worth the price. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum explores the value of pro football in the Gateway City and whether there's enough of it to keep a team here.
When Dave Peacock stepped before a crush of reporters at Union Station last week, his main purpose was to showcase the potential of a new stadium on St. Louis's riverfront. Parts of his pitch were familiar. A new stadium would create construction jobs and provide an economic jolt to downtown. But Peacock's message extended beyond just dollars and cents.
It's about the future of our region. It's about how we are perceived. It's about no longer accepting the notion that our assets can just dissolve in front of us or leave, and that we need to fight for what is rightfully ours.
After St. Louis Rams owner Stan Kroenke unveiled plans to build a stadium outside of Los Angeles, St. Louisans immediately started arguing over how their city should respond. But there's another debate about whether it makes sense to have a football team at all. For pigskin proponents, the argument is partly about economic development and partly about regional pride. Ryan Leffler is the co-owner of Big Daddy's on Laclede's Landing, a restaurant that's located close to where the new stadium would be built and where the Gateway Arch grounds are getting an overhaul.
I am right in the middle of about $1.3 billion of development.
If I can't make... As St. Louis debates a new football stadium, the question of how to pay for it remains. One of the critical funding pieces could be the extension of bonds paying for the Edward Jones Dome. But as St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum reports, the idea is getting a mixed reaction.
The city of St. Louis, St. Louis County, and the state of Missouri provide $24 million each year to pay off bonds for the Edward Jones Dome. Former Anheuser-Busch President Dave Peacock wants to keep those payments going to pay for a new football stadium.
We are confident that the money is available and available in such a way that will not add an incremental burden on our community.
But St. Louis County Councilman Mark Harder doesn't buy the argument that extending bonds is not an expanded commitment of public taxes.
It's kind of like taking a home equity loan to buy a car, where in this case we're taking a home equity loan to buy a car dealership.
While the proposal isn't finalized yet, a bond extension could provide $300 million to $350 million for a new stadium. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon is leading the charge for a new football stadium on St. Louis's riverfront. But there's growing consensus to have legislative votes or a vote of the people to approve the stadium's public financing. As St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum reports, that demand may complicate the bid to make the new stadium a reality.
So here's where we are in the saga of the St. Louis Rams. The team is still on the verge of moving to Inglewood, California, and Missouri's power brokers are scrambling for a way to keep professional football in the Gateway City. In response, Governor Jay Nixon is aggressively promoting a plan to build a roughly $1 billion stadium on St. Louis's riverfront. He and other supporters firmly believe St. Louisans will embrace the outdoor facility.
This is a significant chance for St. Louis to redo that riverfront in an iconic, positive way and stay an NFL city at the same time.
Sounds like a can't-miss proposition, right? Well, not according to some skeptical elected officials. As currently envisioned, the new stadium would get part of its funding from extending the bonds that paid for the Edward Jones Dome. And it's possible that the state and St. Louis could pay off the cost of the new facility without a vote of the General Assembly or without the approval of a citywide referendum. That's not sitting too well with elected officials from across the political spectrum. They contend that even if bonds for a new facility could be extended through a stroke of a pen, some sort of vote should happen anyway. That's the view of Democratic officials like St. Louis Alderwoman Donna Behringer, who wants city voters to weigh in on the project.
The city of St. Louis residents heard it from me, and that's the way...
The St. Louis Board of Aldermen has given its final blessing to a financial package aimed at keeping the St. Louis Rams in town. As St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum reports, it will be up to NFL owners to decide if the gambit pays off.
The funding plan would use city general revenue dollars and event-related taxes to help fund the $1.1 billion facility. Proponents such as Alderman Jack Coder say the proposal could spur economic development and spruce up a part of St. Louis's riverfront.
And so I would ask my colleagues to please pass this bill today to show the NFL and those owners that we're serious about remaining an NFL city.
But the bill's passage doesn't guarantee that the stadium gets built. NFL owners could approve Rams owner Stan Kroenke's request to relocate, and they may not pony up $300 million toward the project. Still, the plan may be enough to stymie Kroenke's bid to move, NFL owners will consider relocation requests in mid-January. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio.
Missouri's General Assembly adjourned this month without addressing a budget shortfall that transportation officials say will devastate the state's roads and bridges over the next few years. As St. Louis Public Radio's Joseph Leahy reports, there's little dispute MoDOT desperately needs more funding. The trouble is getting lawmakers to agree on where to find it.
The I-270 overpass at New Florissant Road has metal nets fastened underneath to catch crumbling concrete before it lands on traffic below. The bridge needs to be replaced, but MoDOT doesn't have the funds. Instead, local officials hold a press conference near the highway's exit ramp to illustrate the problem that MoDOT's regional engineer, Greg Horn, says is expected to get worse.
So roads like Lindbergh, Manchester, Olive, Clarkson, Highway...
As St. Louis gets ready to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Gateway Arch, there's another riverfront attraction you might not know about, the Gateway Geyser. It's part of a unique park on the Illinois riverfront, and in a way, it's the missing piece in architect Eero Saarinen's design for the arch. St. Louis Public Radio's Mary Leonard has the story.
When the Gateway Geyser's engines reach warp speed, 7,500 gallons of water per minute erupt into the sky above the East St. Louis riverfront. If it's not windy, the blast can reach 600 feet, nearly the height of the Gateway Arch, which is directly across the Mississippi River. Jillian Booth, a tourist from London, England, stopped by on a recent afternoon to watch the show.
So this is pretty cool, getting some pictures. So yeah, it's pretty incredible. It's a lot of water. Oh, wow!
The 10-minute spectacle can be seen for miles. But the best place to watch is where Booth is standing, a viewing platform.
On the final day when we put the last piece, I happened to be on the Derrick phones, and they consisted of talking to the operator, which was on the ground, and he'd operate the crane from in a shed. I could see, he couldn't see. Just had to kind of draw him a mental picture.
My name is Jack Wright, civil engineer, graduate from Missouri School of Mines. Was it going to fit? I don't think people were really waiting for a problem. They just wanted to see. It was like a football team scoring a touchdown. That's what happened. It worked.
The only thing different with the last section, there was quite a few people around, and everybody in the city of St. Louis seemed like they just quit what they were doing. At that point, we were used to what we were doing on the arch, and other than all the interest that it generated with other people, with the steamboats and the helicopters, and just made a big ceremony out of it.
It was probably the biggest spectator sport at that particular time of day on that day.
My name is Clarence Cherry. I work for St. Louis Testing Laboratories, x-raying the welds on the arch itself. We worked at night because we worked with radiation. As each section was x-rayed by our company, you got higher and higher and higher, and the weather was changed. It was cold. Wind was terrific sometimes. Sometimes it'd be barely blowing. Hot, rain, storms. I've been down there.
United Believers in Christ Ministries' new home is literally just that, a converted house, its kitchen removed to make way for rows of chairs and decals that look like stained glass on the windows.
I'm so proud of my little windows.
Pastor David Triggs welcomed churchgoers to the first service at the new space yesterday.
You are here celebrating our first day in our new building. Amen.
Speaking on the front porch, Triggs says his church did have to move to a new neighborhood.
There's also a lot of work to do here in Baden, so we're looking forward to reaching out to get to know this community and for them to get to know us.
Triggs says membership has been growing since the fire, so while his ministry is settled for the time being, he hopes to move again in a few months to a larger space, one that's already designed as a church. I'm Stephanie Lecce, St. Louis Public Radio.
You know, when you're trying to solve an old problem, sometimes it's good to take a fresh approach. That's the basic premise behind St. Louis Public Schools' new effort to sell more than 20 schools left empty by decades of declining enrollment. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Tim Lloyd tells us, the longer a school stays empty, the more problems it can attract.
And Virginia Savage can tell you all about those problems.
I met up with her in front of Marshall Elementary in the Ville neighborhood of North St. Louis. The school's been empty for 6 years, and its once stately facade is now filled with broken windows. But Savage sees something much worse than the crumbling building.
Drug dealers, drug users, nowhere for the kids to go. Eyesore, that's what I see.
Savage grew up around here and volunteers at a neighborhood church that's run out of what used to be an empty school. So she doesn't just see problems, she also sees potential for this building.
Apartments, room for the homeless, community center. It's a lot that can go on with this building.
To help sell developers on those types of projects, St. Louis Public Schools put together the Building Revitalization Collaborative. And because this is, after all, a story about real estate, the first thing on their to-do list was throwing a whole bunch of open houses, like this one at Elliott Elementary in North St. Louis. So here's some of what I saw while walking around what you might call the ultimate fixer-upper.
All right, I am on the fourth floor of the school, and I'm just going to step over a big pile of what looks like maybe was insulation at one point in time. And it is just a bizarre scene. There's insulation thrown all over the place. The sub-ceiling is down. Paint is stripped off the walls. All the copper is out of the building. The alarm system's been ripped out. It looks like the set for a post-apocalyptic film.
Post something. Post-population flight, you know, post-declining enrollment and diminishing resources.
That's Walker Gaffney, a middle-aged guy who's leading this open house wearing an orange shirt and khakis. And if he looks a little like a realtor, that's because his job with the district is to sell buildings like Elliott, which is listed for just under.
The rise in heroin addiction in St. Louis has strained drug treatment resources at a time when the need for them is great. In the final segment in our series on our region's opiate problem, St. Louis Public Radio's Camille Phillips investigates the challenges St. Louisans face when trying to overcome their addiction.
In November 2013, Kari Caritas got a call from a local hospital telling her that her son Chaz was in cardiac arrest and she needed to hurry to the ER. When she arrived, she was told her son had died. All she could do was go into his room and say goodbye.
I just sat there. I'm not sure how long. I just remember sitting there going, I can't look at this, but I can't leave.
Caritas found out her son was addicted to heroin 6 months before he died of an overdose. She put Chaz in rehab right away, but he struggled to stay clean. He eventually landed in Madison County's drug court, a legal recourse for addicts who have committed nonviolent crimes. Caritas says the court recommended residential rehab, but there wasn't a bed available. A few weeks later, Chaz left the outpatient center after his day's meetings were over and ended up dead.
I was new to this whole process, so I didn't know what to ask, and I also didn't know how to fight for my child and what was best for him. I thought that the system was developed to do that.
Drug treatment centers in the St. Louis area have a lot more space for outpatient therapy than residential care. That's according to a survey conducted by St. Louis Public Radio.
Public officials around Missouri were shocked today by the news that State Auditor Tom Schweik has died as a result of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. St. Louis Public Radio's Joe Manis has the details.
Schweik shot himself this morning at his home in Clayton. He was transported to Barnes Jewish Hospital. The 54-year-old Republican was a passionate politician who had been in the midst of getting his 2016 campaign for governor off the ground.
It's time to put a true anti-corruption expert in the governor's mansion. Auditing the state is good. Leading the state is going to be even better.
Schweik was a St. Louis native and lawyer whose drive first attracted the attention of former Senator John Danforth, a fellow Republican who became his mentor. Schweik spent roughly a decade in various key federal posts before returning home to run for state auditor in 2010. Since taking office, Schweik headed up a number of investigations of state and local governments. In an appearance before the St. Louis Chamber last fall, Schweik made clear his love for his job.
What's so neat about the job is, you know, one day you're in the streets dealing with traffic tickets, the next day you're in the Supreme Court challenging the governor, but everything is done and designed to help the people of Missouri, to help the taxpayers, and that's why it's such an honor to be in this job.
After easily winning re-election in November, Schweik declared he was ready for the next step. At his January kickoff for governor, Schweik portrayed himself as a crusader.
I am running for governor. I intend to win this election, and you have my word that as governor, I will clean up Jefferson City with a level of intensity, tenacity, transparency, and rigor that this state has never seen before.
Schweik leaves behind his mother, his wife Kathy, and two children. I'm Joe Manis.
The death of State Auditor Tom Schweik sent shockwaves throughout Missouri. With his passing, a hugely varied career and life was cut short and leaves many struggling for answers. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum takes a look at Schweik's life in government and politics and why his death is prompting introspection and sadness.
Tom Schweik was a rare breed in Missouri politics. He didn't methodically climb up the legislative ranks to get to his position. He outflanked powerful politicians to capture an office that can be a stepping stone for prominence. And after winning a second term as state auditor without Democratic opposition, Schweik eyed the governor's mansion. He was willing to get there by decrying what he saw as corruption within the state's political world.
The worst of it, quite frankly, is right where my main office is in Jefferson City, Missouri, the very capital, which is overrun with special interests that have completely corrupted that government there. I hate to say it, but it's true. A lot of people there are not looking out for you. They're looking out for themselves.
But Schweik's rapid political climb has come to a startling end. He died on Thursday from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The news is a shock to the state's political system, but much more importantly, Schweik's death is stunning from a human perspective. A native of Clayton, Schweik graduated from Yale and Harvard University. He spent nearly two decades with the Bryan Cave Law Firm.
Missouri Republican Party Chairman John Hancock conducted a media blitz today. He was denying accusations that he was behind an anti-Semitic whispering campaign to hurt State Auditor Tom Schweik's bid for governor. St. Louis Public Radio's Joe Manis explains.
Schweik, who was not Jewish, had alleged such attacks in the months and minutes before he shot himself on the morning of February 26th. Former Senator John Danforth repeated the allegations in his homily at Schweik's funeral. Some of Schweik's allies have called on Hancock to step down, but Hancock says his reputation is at stake.
If I just walked away from this post, I think in the eyes of many, I would be confessing to having done something that I just simply didn't do.
Hancock also made public earlier emails from Danforth that appeared to indicate he believed Hancock's denials. Danforth has not responded. I'm Joe Manis, St. Louis Public Radio.
The chief of police in the St. Louis suburb of Clayton says there's no reason to believe that the death today of Missouri Auditor Tom Schweik is anything but a suicide. St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman reports.
Chief Kevin Murphy says officers responding to a 911 call found Schweik with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Paramedics transported him to Barnes Jewish Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Murphy told reporters that the investigation remains in an early stage.
We are conducting a thorough investigation, and we're doing what we would do in any similar circumstance. Everything at this point suggests that it is an apparent suicide.
Murphy says one other relative was in the house at the time of Schweik's death. He did not specify whom. He also had no information about a suicide note. I'm Rachel Lippman, St. Louis Public Radio.
Missouri is generally recognized as a leader when it comes to juvenile justice. Kids live in group homes rather than big prison-like facilities. They get treatment from specialists rather than supervision by prison guards. But a July report from the U.S. Department of Justice has raised questions about the constitutionality of the process that puts kids in the system to begin with. St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman explains the disconnect.
The allegations against St. Louis County, outlined in a conference call by Vanita Gupta, the head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, are damning.
The investigation found that the court fails to provide constitutionally required due process to children appearing for delinquency proceedings, and that the court's administration of juvenile justice discriminates against black children, all in violation of the 14th Amendment.
The report found that black youth are more likely to end up in the system than their white counterparts and are treated more harshly once there. Kids of all races rarely have a chance to challenge the charges against them. Low-income children have limited access to attorneys, and the attorneys that do show up are discouraged from being zealous advocates.
Did anything in the DOJ report on St. Louis County really surprise you?
No.
Trish Harrison is a former juvenile public defender and the supervisor of the Children and Youth Advocacy Clinic at the St. Louis University School of Law.
The system has been set up this way since I've been practicing, since the 90s. Things have changed, and not for the better.
The federal investigation focused on St. Louis County.
For almost a decade, students from Washington University Medical School's Gross Anatomy class have held a ceremony honoring their, quote, first patients, people who have donated their bodies to the med school so future doctors could learn anatomy. St. Louis Public Radio's Willis Ryder Arnold has this audio postcard from inside the lab and the ceremony when the class is over.
We are trying to separate, well, I'm trying to separate the bicep from the rest of the muscles here in the forearm or the upper arm.
I remember I told my godfather I wanted to be a doctor when I was like, you know, 10, 11, 12, and he brought me into a C-section. After that moment, you know, it was very clear that this is what I wanted to do. I loved it. I loved the experience. My name is Jorge Zarate. I am 22, and I'm a first-year medical student at WashU.
Lindsay Cole. I'm 23 years old, and I'm a second-year medical student. You walk in, and you see sheets covering bodies on the table, and you know that that's what's underneath there, but you can't see them yet.
Okay, this is the artery.
This one.
You know, the cadaver is essentially my first patient.
It's really an interesting thing, and it makes you get to know what your future patients are going to be like in a way that you could never any other way.
It's a very bizarre experience because you expect it to start bleeding, but it doesn't. And so it's like a very surreal experience. The hands and feet are covered with this like fabric to protect them from getting dry and brittle. So we remove the fabric to start dissecting the hand, and then we realize that our cadaver, she had her nails painted. She had nail polish on. It reminds you that the cadaver had a life, had preferences.
Pawpaw French is a dialect once spoken throughout eastern Missouri that originated with early settlers, but over the last century it's become nearly extinct. Now, a couple of 20-somethings are hoping to save the obscure language, starting classes at Harvest Education in St. Louis. St. Louis Public Radio's Stephanie Lecce brings us their story.
How do you plan to learn a nearly dead sub-dialect of French?
I don't know, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it.
I'm Nathaniel O'Leary.
I'm 20.
I've been studying French for about 5 years. And then one day I just found myself on the internet just looking up dialects of French that existed here in North America. And then I found this one little dialect of French that was called Pawpaw French. Pawpaw French. Except when I discovered it, it wasn't labeled as Pawpaw French. It was labeled as Missouri French. And I thought, Missouri French? What the heck is this? Why are there French speakers in Missouri? This dialect formerly is called Illinois Country French. It was spoken all the way from Vincennes, Indiana, all the way over here to the Ozarks. St. Genevieve, Potosi, Missouri, which back then it was called La Mino Breton. 300 ans, on est toujours ici. It translates to 300 years, we're still here. There's actually a big sign with that in Old Mines, Missouri. It says that. So I just kind of fell in love with it, started studying it. I just thought it was so cool. I thought the accent was amazing. We even have words for animals that don't even exist in standard French, like a bullfrog. In standard French, the closest thing that they would say is un grand grenouille. But we say un wawaron. Wawaron is an onomatopoeia that the French actually inherited from the Native Americans.
Including a recent high school crowd.
That's terrible.
45 kids burst through the doors and peel off into separate groups. 15-year-old Chastity Buckner stares at the slave hold with new understanding.
To actually see the ship where the slaves were kept, it surprised me because I didn't know it was actually like that cramped and like blood everywhere.
So that was kind of hard to imagine yourself in that situation?
Yes, because it is my ancestors.
The number of school groups and visitors overall has fallen off from 35,000 a year to 4,000. That's a crippling blow for an organization that makes most of its money from entrance fees. The Griot owns its building, but the museum struggles to pay its bills. Conley can't always pay herself, but still she works almost every day.
I'm it. I'm the staff. I'm the curator. I'm the accountant. I'm the janitor.
Conley cleans the toilets and takes out the trash several times a week. She's 69 years old, and the job's not getting any easier. And it can be discouraging when the big money is going to larger institutions. Last month, St. Louis-based Emerson gave $5 million to the Missouri History Museum for African American exhibitions. Samuel Black is president of the Association of African American Museums. He says it's typical for Black institutions to struggle while mainstream...
Activist groups are planning undisclosed acts of civil disobedience Monday following a weekend of events marking the first anniversary of the death of Michael Brown. St. Louis Public Radio's Camille Phillips has more.
Over the past year, protesters have briefly shut down area highways and demonstrated in area stores. But activists aren't yet saying where or when today's actions will take place. Montega Simmons is chair of St. Louis's Organization for Black Struggle, one of the groups planning the disruptions. He says the goal will be to heighten people's awareness of injustice.
For us, it's a fight to say that we have the right to actually be protected. And we should expect the same kind of accountability in the system that folks get when they live in other places. policing in our community should not have to be different. And if it weren't different, we wouldn't see continuing loss of black lives.
Simmons says government, law offices, and people who benefit from the current system are all possible targets of the actions. I'm Camille Phillips, St. Louis Public Radio.
Last night, nationally recognized musicians gathered for a free concert at FUBAR, a club near Grand Center, to remember Michael Brown. St. Louis Public Radio's Willis Ryder Arnold asked performers how they thought concerts contributed to the Black Lives Matter movement.
As protesters took to the streets in Ferguson, event organizers at FUBAR gathered canned goods for donation to Ferguson food banks and money for Michael Brown's family. Organizers felt the concert was one way to give back to a grieving community. According to rapper Pharrell Monk, the event also reminds people that little has changed in 1 year.
If you're not in the midst of it, it may even seem unreal to people outside of the struggle that's happening.
Performers like Monk and the other artists that performed said they will continue discussing the Black Lives Matter movement in their work. I'm Willis Ryder Arnold, St. Louis Public Radio.
Let's ask what difference a year has made in Ferguson, Missouri. It is nearly a year since an unarmed black teenager was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, sparking many protests.
Significant political and racial tensions remain in Ferguson and the St. Louis region, despite some cautious optimism about change. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum reports.
As the clock ticks closer to the August 9th anniversary of Michael Brown's death, there's a tranquil aura around the corner coffee house in Ferguson. Daily protests have petered out, and the hordes of reporters who camped out here have moved on to the next story. But there is no new normal for people like John Powell, a Catholic school teacher who's lived in Ferguson for 9 years. He says the Ferguson he knew is gone.
For many of us, we've had our consciousness changed. There's a lot of good people in Ferguson before the shooting, a lot of good people after who want to make us a model, hopefully for the rest of the country in terms of addressing the racism, the police abuse, the municipal court abuse.
In the last 12 months, Ferguson became synonymous with exposing painful racial and economic strains. But for more than 20,000 people, Ferguson isn't just a symbol or a hashtag. It's a place reeling from conflict and intense scrutiny. But to say that Brown's death didn't change things in Ferguson would be an overstatement. A city government once lacking diversity now has a black city manager, police chief, and municipal court judge. And in April, voters turned out in unprecedented numbers to elect African Americans like Wesley Bell to the Ferguson City Council.
We got to understand that the message is important. And when we see governmental body, for example, that doesn't reflect the community, some people may not feel, they may be put off by that.
Even before state lawmakers passed a sweeping overhaul of the municipal court system that critics say bedeviled minority motorists, Ferguson officials talked a lot about bridging the divide here. It's a major focus for Interim Police Chief Andre Anderson.
We want to embrace professionalism. We want to embrace respect. We want to embrace community engagement, and we want to make the community safe.
But these structural and philosophical alterations haven't relieved all the tension.
It's hard to forget the images. Shattered glass, fires, and looters running in and out of stores. The shops along West Florissant Avenue in Ferguson and Delwood endured a lot in the days and months following Michael Brown's death. As part of Ferguson, 1 year later, St. Louis Public Radio's Maria Altman checks to see how some of those businesses are faring now.
Cars stream past on West Florissant Avenue. At this spot a year ago, TV personalities like CNN's Anderson Cooper did live stand-ups here. Today, it's back to being a parking lot.
It's a busy parking lot.
Yes, people drive crazy around here.
I'm talking with Priyanka Patel, whose father owns Ferguson Market and Liquor. I ask her if lots of cars mean it's busy inside.
Yeah, a little busy, yes. Not as it used to be, but still busy.
How has it changed?
We have a lot of our good customers that move out of the area.
Really?
Yes.
It hasn't been easy. The store was looted in August and again in November. Each time they cleaned up and reopened. A lot of businesses along this street went through the same thing, including Zisser Tire and Auto Service. There are lots of new tires and shiny hubcaps in the front shop, but at least for the time being, many of the windows are still covered in plywood.
The boards are a pretty good insulator. I think they're better than glass.
Owner John Zisser has a way of looking.
Last year, around this time, we aired a story in which two of our reporters, Stephanie Lecce and Dori Buscarin, took shelter with the Moore family during a night of protest in Ferguson that turned violent. It's been a year of change in the North County suburb, and the Moores have had a front seat. Buscarin went back to visit them on a quiet Sunday afternoon.
There are a few nights that stand out during the unrest last year as being particularly devastating, and August 17, 2014 was one of them. After reports of a shooting in the early evening, police ordered hundreds of protesters to clear the area. Then, canisters of tear gas were thrown into the crowd, followed by rubber bullets. Stephanie Lecce and I were stranded a few miles from our cars. We knocked on the door of a house with the lights still on and met Irma Moore.
And now I just want it all to end. Because this is day 9 of being up all night and, you know, somebody on watch, whether it be my son, my husband, something.
That was a year ago. Today, Moore and I are sitting on that same couch, and I asked her why she decided to open the door that night.
I'm scared to death. I mean, you know, given the whole week and then the months before and just like everything, I didn't know what to think, but I felt really bad. And I don't know, something told me, open the door.
The Moores live just a few blocks away from where many of those first protests were.
If you looked out on the porch, everything was on fire and cars were burning. People were going everywhere. Noise, helicopters, rage. And then to be 3 months pregnant at the same time, all I could think about was how stressful it was to get up and go to work the next day.
Moore says two of her younger daughters are still coping with the trauma. They have a hard time sleeping in their own beds, get nervous when they hear a helicopter. She bought a bar to keep across the door, and that seemed to help. But there are still lingering memories of the times last year when she would try to call the police for help.
We called because that auto place back there was on fire. Mm-hmm. And someone had kept coming up the street to light this gas station. He said if you fear for your safety, you know, you can leave, but where do you go?
A lot has happened this year for the family. Moore still works as an assistant principal, but she's making plans to open up a preschool in the area. 11-year-old Briadora, who said she couldn't go to soccer practice because of the unrest, won a regional championship with her team this year. And in February, the Moores welcomed a little girl, Elizabeth.
We had contemplated moving for a little bit. We circled around that, and we just decided, you know what, that we won't allow them.
Dozens of shots rang out on West Florissant Avenue in Ferguson last night as two groups of people exchanged gunfire near a protest. St. Louis Public Radio's Duri Buscarin reports.
A late-night protest had begun to wind down when dozens of shots rang through the air. Ferguson resident Roberta Lynch ran for cover.
Michael Brown is at rest. We need to let Michael Brown rest in peace. He got taken away, an unfortunate incident, but we need to let this go. In the name of Jesus, we really do.
St. Louis County Police reported that two groups of people had exchanged gunfire near the protest. Four officers followed a suspect who then allegedly shot at them. The officers opened fire, and the individual is in critical condition. Police cleared the area a couple hours later. St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar says he could not confirm if officers used tear gas or smoke. I'm Duri Buscarin, St. Louis.
When St. Louis County Executive Steve Stanger issued a state of emergency order on Monday, he placed the St. Louis County Police Department in charge of securing Ferguson's protests. And former St. Louis County Police Chief Tim Fitch says that move was necessary after violence erupted on Sunday.
Something needed to change, and I thought it was a good move on the county executive's part to remove the Ferguson police chief from command.
But St. Louis County Councilwoman Hazel Irby questioned whether the state of emergency order was creating a national panic.
I'm getting calls from my family saying, I want you out of there. You know, out of St. Louis, and we're not feeling that.
Stanger justified his move by contending St. Louis County Police helped stabilize the situation. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio.
You know, in getting ready for this show, we found this video clip. It was recorded during the homecoming celebration at the University of Missouri on October 10th.
Like most colleges, homecoming at Mizzou, the flagship school for the state, is a really big deal.
And in this video, the homecoming parade is about to get underway.
In the lead car is Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri's four-campus system. He's sitting in the back seat of a red 1970s muscle car. It's a convertible, and the top is down.
That's when a group of black students steps in front of the vehicle.
Hi, Tim Wolf. How you doing?
And using bullhorns and their own bodies, they form a line and demand to know how Wolf plans to address a series of racial incidents on campus.
But he doesn't get out of the car to talk with the protesters.
This is not an indictment on white folks, but it is an indictment on white structures and white supremacy.
Can say that.
Wolf's car inches forward and starts bumping protesters out of the way. Eventually, the police are called to disperse the students. In response, the crowd, almost all white, cheers. After being pushed onto the sidewalk, a young black protester grabs a bullhorn and says this.
There will not continue to be called niggers on this campus. Believe that. All y'all in silence, y'all are part of the problem. All y'all in silence, y'all are part of the problem. Everything is against me, and you are the problem.
And the parade went on. But the story wasn't over. Nearly a month after the homecoming incident, student activists again confronted Wolf as he walked out of a fundraiser in Kansas City. They asked him to define systematic oppression. That exchange also was captured on video.
I will give you an answer, and I'm sure it will be a wrong answer.
You gonna Google it?
I will give you an answer, and I'm sure it will be a wrong answer.
What do you think systematic oppression is?
Systematic oppression is because you don't believe that you have the equal opportunity for success.
You don't believe it!
Did you just blame us
for systematic oppression, Tim Wolf?
By now, you've probably heard or read headlines about what happened next. A student named Jonathan Butler went on a hunger strike, vowing not to eat until Wolf stepped down. Then some MU football players said they wouldn't play until Wolf left. And on November 9th, he did.
That same day, officials demoted Mizzou's campus chancellor, R. Bowen Lofton. The university system worked quickly to install a new interim president who has vowed to address racial issues on campus, among other things.
And as much as we, like the rest of the nation, have been following this Mizzou saga, there was something that just kept bugging us.
Yeah, why was it so hard for Tim Wolf, the president of a top-tier university system, to define systematic oppression?
Didn't anybody ask him about race relations before he got the job?
On today's show, we go in search of those answers.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
So just a quick programming note that we had planned to make this show about gaps in academic achievement. And we'll still get to that, but we felt like with all the student activism that's happening on college campuses across the country, we needed to spend some more time with this story.
Okay, back to our first question. Did anybody ask Tim Wolf about race before he got the job as president of a public university system with 77,000 students?
In all honesty, not that I recall. I think, and probably that was the case with all the other people we interviewed.
That's Wayne Good. He was on the selection committee that picked Wolf to lead the UM system 4 years ago. Wayne tells us they went through dozens of candidates before settling on Wolf.
It could even be seen as somewhat insulting to ask a lot of people who were all at a pretty good level in their careers whether or not they felt they could deal with it. Because you
when you
would,
say deal you with would, that, like what do you mean by deal with that?
Well, deal with any issues that may arise, and they don't arise all the time or everywhere. But when they do come up,
any issues that may arise, just to be clear, about race or about
race and human resources.
Wayne tells us that race relations just weren't top of mind, and in his opinion, they've gotten a lot better since when he was on campus.
I can tell you when I was a student there in the late 50s, I graduated in 60, there was a lot of racism. There was a lot of racism everywhere, but on the campus too, and a lot of prejudice over religion. You know, a lot changed in the 60s and since then. And but some things with some people, I guess, never change. And you had this situation here.
Given the history of that, why wouldn't that come up? Why wouldn't race relations on Mizzou's campus come up, or should it have come up?
Well, in the interview process?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm talking about a time that's over 50 years ago. So, you know, that's a different era. I mean, a really, truly different era. Things are sometimes...
This is St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU, 67 degrees at 7:04. Good morning. I'm Wayne Pratt. Many residents of Ferguson and members of the city's police department are still trying to find answers following this week's shooting death of a 9-year-old girl. Relatives and neighbors joined officers last night to hold a vigil and release balloons in honor of Jamila Bolden. She was killed this week when someone fired into a home. The girl was hit by a bullet while doing homework on her mother's bed. Ferguson Police Sergeant Dominica Fuller says no arrests have been made and a motive is not clear.
Our community is helping us. We're receiving a lot of calls. Anytime a child's life is taken to gun violence, we're going to get as much help as possible. And we're pleading to the media and the community to help us get this resolved.
More than 200 people attended last night's vigil. Questions also surround the aftermath of a deadly officer-involved shooting this week in St. Louis. Many protesters who took to the streets after the death of Mansour Balbay say police did not give proper warning before dispersing the crowd with tear gas. St. Louis Metropolitan Police Chief Sam Dotson, who criticized the approach by police in Ferguson last year, says proper notice was given this week and he is standing behind the tactics used by his officers on Wednesday night. The procedure debate has emerged as residents of the North St. Louis neighborhood come to terms with the 18-year-old's death and the unrest that followed. Family members are also trying to make sense of it all. Here's St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum.
On late Thursday morning, Debbie Ball was cleaning up the front yard of a Fountain Park apartment where her nephew was killed. Police say Balbay pointed a gun at officers, but Ball says she's still processing what happened.
I haven't even looked at the news. To tell y'all the truth, I haven't grieved. I haven't done anything because it ain't registered in with me yet.
Ball witnessed protesters clash with police on Wednesday, a night that also saw a car in a vacant building burn. She says that shouldn't have happened.
I want the people not to be down here destroying our community down here because we ain't got nothing down here anyway. So what you want to come down here and then mess more of it up for?
Ball and other Fountain Park residents say the neighborhood has been plagued with crime, drugs, and violence. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio.
In other news, Missouri's governor is reiterating his support for turning Interstate 70 into a toll road as a means of improving transportation in the state. Jay Nixon says he believes the levy of a user fee for I-70 is appropriate.
Almost 9 out of every 10 pennies that would be spent there would be from folks outside Missouri with the federal dollars and then the folks traveling through here. So you can get a road built, 90% a brand new road by non-Missourians that we use a lot. I think that still is something that should be looked at very carefully.
He made the comments yesterday at the Missouri State Fair. Nixon also voiced support for raising the state's fuel tax to provide more transportation funding. Sunshine today with a high around 85, mostly clear tonight, a low in the mid-60s. Clouds tomorrow, chance of showers, high around 80. It's 67 in St. Louis. This is St. Louis Public Radio News.